to A Conspiracy of Lemurs, a Regal House publishing podcast that celebrates the writing craft. Co-hosted by myself, Janie Royal, founder and editor-in-chief at Regal House Publishing, and Pam Van Dyke, Regal's erudite managing editor. Today, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Mary Hill Wagner to our podcast to discuss the inspiration behind her upcoming Pact Press memoir, Girls in the Hood. Pam, would you be so kind as to introduce our guest?
I'd be delighted. Dr. Mary Hill Wagner grew up in South Los Angeles, more specifically near Manchester and Broadway. During her teenage years, she lived in Compton, California. She holds a master's degree in mass communication from Ohio State University, and she earned a PhD in mass communication from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She has published extensively as a full-time reporter for newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, the Las Vegas Sun, the Simi Valley Enterprise, the Des Moines Register, the Anaheim Bulletin, and others. In addition, she has taught news writing at several universities across the country, including Shaw University and North Carolina Central University, Humboldt State University in California, the University of Southern California, Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, and others. Dr. Wagner considers herself straight out of Compton by way of a few detours. And today we're here to talk to her about her memoir, Girls in the Hood. Welcome, Mary.
Hey, how you doing?
Welcome, Mary. I would like to start, if you'll allow me, by reading a section from the initial query letter from Andrea Somberg at Harvey Klinger Literary Agency. Not only was it a beautiful summation of Mary's work, but it paints a powerful portrait of the remarkable woman who is Mary's mother and around whom this memoir revolves. Girls in the Hood is the unsentimental, moving, and surprisingly humorous account of a girl and her 10 siblings who grew up in one of the roughest neighborhoods in LA. Mary's mother was a fierce matriarch, a single mom who raised 11 children with the help of welfare checks and a firearm hidden in her bra. Drugs, guns, and pregnancies were everyday occurrences, but Mary and her siblings took it all in stride, spying on the grown-ups, playing in the streets, and helping to take care of the new babies when they were born. The dubious yet colorful cast of characters that came into their lives, the Jehovah Witnesses, the whores, the addicts, the fathers, and the never-ending series of hardships, the jail terms, the knife fights, the mental illness and homicides, couldn't shake the core of the family. This is the story of Mary, but even more so, it's the story of her mother, a uniquely strong and extraordinary woman who was able to survive moments of pain and disappointment by laughing at the comedy of human missteps, miscalculations, and downright stupidity. But this is also a story about race and of poverty and how over time it can wear you down and destroy you. Because although Mary got out okay, her sisters and brothers were not so lucky. Mary, perhaps you might share with our listeners what first motivated you to write about your mother and what inspired the formation of this memoir.
Sure. Excuse me. That always gets me choked up when I hear that about my brothers and sisters. But anyway, this began as a writing prompt in a creative writing class many years ago. I was taking a writing class from this wonderful writer, Clancy Siegel, and he gave us this prompt that said, write about someone you admire and why you admire them. And I was stunned when things came back. People had written about, they had written about Thomas Jefferson and movie stars and basketball players, and no one had written about their parents. Except me. And I said that the person I most admired was my mother, because she was so resilient and courageous and kind. And I mean, any other more superlatives I can't think of, but loyal. She was all these things. And when the assignment came back, Clancy asked me, he said, you know, this could be a book. And I said, you know, I was a journalism undergraduate major at USC. And I said, well, you know, a book, you know, I'm going to be a journalist. I'd like to write books someday, but a book, really? And he said, sure, this could be a book, and it would be an important book. And I said, I don't know. But it was always in the back of my mind, a splinter in my mind, that maybe it could be a book. And as the years went by, I would see all of these depictions of South Los Angeles in the movies, you know, Boys in the Hood and South Central and Colors and lesser films like that and Straight Outta Compton and these films. And I would say this is an important part of American cinema. That's an important part of the American story. But where are the women and the girls? Somewhere there are women and girls in that community. I know because I was one. And I wanted to write that story. And so that's where that came from. It came from a crusading instructor that I had who gave me the idea it could be a book. And then I saw for myself that this is a story that was not being told. And I thought that I was the one to tell it.
Fantastic. I saw Boys in the Hood a long time ago and Colors as well. And for me, when I read Girls in the Hood, it really brought that community to life for me in a very, very different way. And say your mother is such a strong character, Sarah is her name. And there was so much there. You covered a lot of ground in your memoir. And so I'm curious to know if you have part of the memoir that is your favorite, maybe something you started with even.
I think that when I was looking back on my whole experience with my mother, my admirable mother, I was thinking about all the different things she taught me. Some things directly and some things indirectly. And some of those things are in the book. I remember one of my favorite parts of the book is how my mother just stood up for others all the time. And she would stand up for her children. And I got into some trouble when I was in like fourth grade because I said the founding fathers weren't much fathers at all. And that was very controversial in the 70s, you know, in the early 70s, we're still in the Vietnam War. And the instructor had a kid over the Vietnam War, and he was not happy that I had said the founding fathers were not the founding fathers, and at least not to Black people. And my mother had to go down to the school and defend me to the teacher. And he said, I want her to tell me why they're not founding fathers. And my mother said, well, she knows that they were slave owners. And then that's not a good track record. And, you know, I kind of got in a little bit of trouble, but my mother was there for me. But on the way home, my mother said, you know, you need to learn this word, discretion. And I said, discretion? I don't know what that means. You know, I'm 7 or 8 or whatever. And she said, you need to learn that you don't have to tell everybody everything all the time that you know. And this is something that the world is not ready to know. They're not ready to have you tear down their icons of Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and people like that. They're not ready. So you need to learn when to speak and when not to speak. And so my favorite parts of the book are where my mother's giving me these lessons. You know, she's sort of my ghetto Yoda.
Well, she certainly had a lot of lessons to teach you and the readers as well. I think it's amazing to me that, as you say, she was very loyal to her community and to people around her and very loyal and protective of her children, as most mothers are. So she really comes alive on the page, and she's an incredible, incredible person.
I wonder, Mary, I found the dialogue in your book particularly powerful. It enabled a strong and visceral immersion in the scenes that you described from your childhood. And I wonder if it was a challenge writing dialogue of scenes set so far in the past, and whether it was a challenge differentiating between those narrative voices insofar as the dialogue was concerned.
You know, sure, it was a bit of a challenge, but the dialogue in my book is constructed from swatches of memory and getting a feel for how people speak and what it says about them when they speak. And I was lucky enough to grow up around a group of characters, I would say, who had very colorful ways of expressing themselves. Okay. And so those things are indelible in my memory. In several passages, I don't say exactly what was said. I say simply the conversation went something like this. Because in this way, I didn't feel the pressure that I felt as a journalist when I was a journalist for years to get every single word correct. This is our mandate as journalists, and get every single word exactly as it was rendered. And some of it, as you say, was half a century ago. But I get the feel of what was said from the person. And I think I was able to do that.
Oh, brilliantly. I felt like I was next to you at the sink, washing dishes, straining to hear the grown-up conversation, and under the table, sort of as family are gathering. I mean, it was incredibly powerful. And I think that the dialogue just really made the environment so viscerally real. It was amazing.
I think it's sometimes so vibrant because when I was reading this parts of this at a workshop when I was originally doing the book, someone said they didn't realize it was a memoir. And someone after the workshop, he came up to me and he said, "What happened to the little girl under the table? Oh my God, I'm so worried for her. Are you going to tell us what happened to her in the next chapter?" And I said, you know, it's okay. She turned out okay. She's fine. So, because it's me, you know.
She did indeed. It's also interesting how you can capture, you know, those years so vibrantly, primarily through dialogue. The dialogue conveys the emotion and the environment and the connection between the individuals that populate the story so well. And it does seem to me as a reader that the dialogue is a huge emotive driver of the memoir narrative in your book and to such powerful and marvelous effect.
Mary, I was going to ask a question. One of the things that struck me about the memoir is that it's told from young Mary's point of view, you looking back as a child, and it starts out that way. And I thought it was really interesting. You have, as you say, you grew up around a lot of characters. They're very vibrant in the memoir. And there are things happening, you know, your uncle's released from jail. And at a certain point, your cousins come to live with you. And then you and a couple of your siblings and your mom are on the street for a while. But there's never a sense of judgment from young Mary. And what you've done for the reader is just to observe, essentially, what it was like to live in that household. I wonder if you'd like to speak to that a little bit.
I think that comes from the fact that I love these people. And just as I said earlier, I love my mother so much and admired her so much that it never occurred to me to judge her choices. Never. Still, you know, many, many years later, I've made different choices in my life and I'm glad for the choices I've made. But I don't judge her choices. Even her brother, my Uncle Lo, he was a consistent male figure in my life when I didn't have a father. So I don't judge his choices either. I love these people just so passionately. And so that's why in the intro, when you said some of my brothers and sisters were not as lucky to survive, I got a little choked up there because just thinking about that these at their core, really decent people fell prey to the many snares in the ghetto is it makes me sad. It makes me sad.
Yeah, I can understand that. As you look back on your life and you look back on your success, what do you think influenced that success?
I made, when I was a reporter, I interviewed this young president of a bank. He was the youngest president of a bank, and we were doing a business story about him. He was in his early 30s. And I asked him about his life. And he told me about this world he existed in where he had five brothers all in prison, and he had a mother in prison and a father in prison and cousins and in motorcycle gangs and all these really terrible things. And then I said, you know, what makes you different, do you think? And he said, choices and consequences. It's that simple. He said, they chose differently. And so I've held on to that. This is many years ago. I've held on to that because I think that's true. It is choices and consequences. And I'm satisfied with the choices and the consequences, the positive consequences of the choices that I've made in my life.
I can imagine it's very difficult if you're growing up and you sort of feel like you don't have so many choices. And, you know, what paths are open to you and how easy is it for you to avail yourself of those opportunities? And that's got to be tough as well.
Yeah, but my mother was always there in the cheering section, and not just for me. She was there in the cheering section for all of my siblings. And so we did have a person that we could look to who we always knew no matter what happened, was on our side. And you can use that to bolster yourself and say, well, you know, I didn't get that fellowship. This is my own experience. I didn't get that scholarship. I didn't get into that particular college. But on the cheering section, my mother would say, you know, you'll get the next one. And so if you can take that and lift up from that, that's something special. And I think that that is the difference. Sometimes people don't have it, even that one person to say, I'm on your side no matter what happens.
Yes. And one of the most remarkable things about your mother, too, despite the challenges and the adversity which your whole family faced, is that she was always there for neighbors as well, who were out on their luck. They could come in and have a good meal and be guaranteed of a seat at the table or in the backyard and a friendly ear. So that support was enormous. And I think it sort of speaks to the size and generosity of her heart.
Yes, I remember we used to, there would be, I don't know if you remember ice cream trucks. Pam, do you remember ice cream trucks?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I do. Running after them, panicked in case I couldn't get inside to get a quarter fast enough and run back out. But yes, I definitely remember ice cream trucks.
Now, we didn't have money for ice cream trucks. So my mother would always on the weekend buy plenty of popsicles. And I'd say, oh, this is a lot of popsicles. So, you know, and so when ice cream truck would go off, we knew we needed to go inside and get a popsicle. But it wasn't just us. It was all the other kids. The ice cream truck guy hated our street because my mother was giving out free ice cream to all the kids. And nobody was coming to the ice cream truck. They're all running over to our house when they would hear the ice cream bell. And I asked my mother, you know, what, isn't this our ice cream? She'd say, no, this is ice cream for children.
So, Mary, now that you're, you know, I guess sort of the end of the road insofar as the publishing, the title is concerned, we are so fortunate as to be able to work with you to bring this marvelous work into the world, which we're so excited about and feel privileged to be a part of it. But I wonder, if you were starting over again and you were writing the book now, is there anything that you would change about the process or about the path to publication?
If anything I would change about the path to publication, I think that I would get myself to some writing workshops earlier. And I would try to find people who were further along in the publishing journey, because I really didn't understand anything about publishing. I mean, I understand the world of journalism because that's my profession and that's where I'm educated, but I didn't understand the publishing of books. And I would have gotten myself to a few writing workshops earlier. I finally found the Santa Barbara Writing Workshop in Santa Barbara, California, but I wish I'd gone to those much sooner and talk to people further along in the publishing journey so I could find out what it is this thing that we call publishing. And I understand it just a tiny bit better now, but I'm still learning every day.
As are we. Yes.
It's true. It's a tricky industry in some ways, because if you're an emerging writer or you've written your first memoir or novel, sometimes it's really difficult to know what the next step is. You finished it, you've edited it, you feel really great about the project, and then where do you go from there? And I think sometimes having a community of writers helps, because some of them have been through that process already and they're able to share that information with you. But you came by way of an agent. How did you get your agent?
Oh my goodness, that was a long and involved, I mean, how much time do you have? No, it was a long process. I at first went to the Santa Barbara Writers Conference and I talked to a couple of dozen agents just to get a feeling. And, you know, they read five pages or they don't read it. And then they say, you know, sit down, we do this sort of like speed dating thing to talk to agents. And then they say, so what did you write about? Oh, I'm not really interested in that. And so I was like, oh, what's this business with agents? And so I'd ask some of the more, if you will, mature writers along the path, and they would say, well, you need to query agents that who are interested in what you're doing. You know, this here is just so you can get a taste of what it is to have an agent. And so I got books. I got lots and lots of books. I started to educate myself about what this business is doing with agents. I didn't even know what an agent did, honestly. And so I just started querying. I started looking at different websites, and I just started, you know, and I was getting like tons of rejections. We don't know where to place this. We don't even know what this is about. Why is there so much swearing? You know? And so this makes me very uncomfortable. I don't know anybody. And one agent said, could we do away with the mother character and maybe I can consider it? And I said, well, no, it's kind of about her. So no, actually. And so just dozens and dozens of dozens of rejections later. And it was weird because after so many months of this, in the same month, I got three different agents to call me and say, I'm interested in this. And I went, oh, why? It was an embarrassment of riches, the only way I can describe it after so much time. And I met with one and we had lunch and he paid for the lunch. I was very impressed. And another one, she said she was actually getting out of the business and she wished me well. And then Andrea Somberg at Harvey Klinger, she called me up and she said, I read this and I would like to represent this. And she said, let me read it again so I can tell you all the parts I really liked. Isn't that terrific? Then I got the agent. Then the process begins again because I didn't know what they did. And she started querying different publishers. And she queried you, obviously, because we're on the radio together or on the podcast. And she queried different publishers and asked them if they would be interested in reading the book. And here we are together. And it's been quite a journey. Quite a journey.
Thank you for sharing that with us, because I know we have listeners who are not quite there yet, not quite ready to query for an agent. And I think sometimes young writers and writers who are working on their first project get discouraged because they query one or two agents and they think, oh, they're not interested. So no one will ever want this novel or this memoir. So it's nice to hear an author talk about the process and maybe patience is part of that, and just getting the right person, just getting in front of the right person who really will champion your work. And I'm very grateful to Andrea Somberg and Harvey Klinger Associates for bringing you our way.
Yeah, I'm grateful for them too.
So that's a nice segue, Pam, into challenges that young writers might have in bringing their work into the market. Do you have any advice for young writers who are seeking to publish their works, Mary, having successfully traversed the path yourself?
Yes, I think that reading, you have to read, if you will, in the genre, what people are writing. That is a challenge in itself for the kind of work that I did for Girls in the Hood. But you have to read, find a tribe. You know, we like to say this at Santa Barbara Writers Workshop. Find the tribe, the group of writers that will encourage you and occasionally give you a kick in the pants when you work on something and it's not quite up to what it should be. I was in one writer's workshop where I'm working on something new. And one of my good friends, he said, it's okay, but it's not up to your usual standards. I think you need to go back and take a look at that just like that. And I said, you know, I respect him. I'm going to do that, you know? And so find that tribe, find the tribe that'll like be your cheering section, but will also like help you do your best work. That's what would be part of my advice. Find a mentor. Sadly, I didn't really find a mentor for this part of my career, but you can also be a mentor and learn from that. And I have several young writers that I give advice to because they're now starting their publishing journey. So you can find a mentor or be a mentor. That would be my advice. You should read in the genre, find your tribe, and find a mentor or be one.
Fantastic. One of the things that I'm always interested in, I dabble in writing. I haven't been published widely, and I certainly have not published a long form project like a novel or a memoir, but I'm always interested to know what a writer's routine is. Do you write every day? Do you have a special place you like to write? Can you share that with us?
I do have a home office, but strangely, most of my writing doesn't happen in my home office. I have, you know, I have all my books here. I mean, it's just stacked up to the wall with all my books and papers and computers and things. But I find that my most creative time, and this is going to sound odd, but it's my thing, are in my garden. I'm doing some fiction right now instead of nonfiction. I'm doing some fiction and I'm trying to get a particular character. And I have three main characters, which I've been told that's a big pill to swallow, but I'm going to do it. Two of them I have exactly rendered so that they're so real. You know, you can walk up to them. And there's a third one I'm having a challenge with. And so I go to my garden and, you know, and I pull up flowers and I pull up weeds and I think about the character and what she's like and what she does and how she speaks and what she wears. And does she go to church? Does she have a cat? Does she have a dog? And so my writing takes place. My writing actually takes place not necessarily at the computer when I'm doing a character development. It actually takes place in my garden. And I know that sounds odd, but it's true. It happens to be true.
I feel the same way. I sometimes will take a long walk. If I'm stuck and I can't quite break through, I'm having a plot challenge or narrative challenge and I'm walking around and all of a sudden the answer comes to me and I think, oh, that wasn't so hard. It was right there. It was right there in my brain. I needed to get away from the computer to be able to let it come to me. So thank you for sharing that. That's great.
Mary, I was wondering, given your extensive background in publications and academic degrees in communication and in journalism, how do you think that has affected the writing of this memoir? Do you see the reporter's voice within that memoir narrative? It almost seems like, as Pam referred to earlier, the young Mary does act very much as sort of a quiet observer. And I just wondered whether the training and that sort of academic background, whether that influenced the way in which you wrote this.
Early on when I was writing this, the drafts of this, I found that my journalism background was a bit of a handcuff, to tell you the truth. It was a bit of a handcuff because we have very strict protocols in journalism, and it has to be correct, exactly what the person said, exactly what you saw. I mean, it's like a witness to a crime kind of thing. You're a witness to a crime. This is going to be presented in court. This has to be right. And I had several people at workshops. Thank you, John Reed, Santa Barbara Writers Workshop, who said, you know, you can let some of that go and just let the writing do the work. And I had to let some of that go because otherwise I'm stymied. I'm sitting there. I'm thinking about what exactly was said. Exactly what did I see? You know, because as a reporter, I actually had to let some of that reporter part of me, I had to let some of that go.
It does make sense. I think because in journalism, as you say, you're reporting facts. That's different than looking back at a period in your life and telling the events to the best of your knowledge, truthfully, but also you're interpreting them somewhat in that you're looking back and things, you know, have changed over time. But in terms of structure, the memoir is really told primarily from a young Mary's point of view. Did you consider that when you were thinking about the structure, making it be in young Mary's point of view versus Mary now looking back and interpreting events based on things that have happened in the intervening years?
I did think about that, but I said, no, I'm not going to do that. Because I don't think I would have been up to the challenge of you want to fix things. You want to fix it. I mean, as an adult looking back, I would want to go back and I would want to fix stuff. And I would want to say, well, then this is when I found that bag of gold and we were fine. And so it didn't happen that way. So I decided that, no, I'm going to put it in the viewpoint of how it happened at the time it happened, because as an adult looking back, I can see a lot of places where I would have just fixed it. So just fix it.
I just love that you did that, Mary, because young Mary's perspective was so delightful It's so delightful because she has this innocence, but also a great wisdom, kind of a canniness. You know, she knows exactly what she needs to do to get, you know, to be unnoticed. And she's learning what should be said and what shouldn't as her mother cues her in. But I think her perspective is perfect for the telling of this novel because we see your mother through her eyes. And that's exactly how it should be. That's exactly how it should be, I feel.
Yeah, I also considered writing it from my mother's perspective, actually, in the very beginning. But here's the challenge that I wasn't up to. She sometimes did and said things that I did not understand. And I could not get into her motivation. I couldn't get in. I can get into my own motivations, but I couldn't get into her motivations. And I couldn't quite get there as a writer, as a human being. Why did she say it like that? Why did she do that? What was that about? And some things, even as I'm now older than she was when she passed, some things I still don't understand. I mean, I rendered them there on the page, but I don't understand them. So I thought it would be best if I did it from my view of what was happening, just as an observer.
It does seem that ultimately, you really have to walk in her shoes, don't you, to really understand. And you walked in your shoes and you wrote about walking in your shoes. And I think that's got to be an easier endeavor.
It works beautifully. Our last podcast was with Julie Witzschlack and Jane Bernstein, who both are memoirists, and Jane is a fiction writer as well. One of the questions that we asked them, and I'd like to ask you, when you were writing, you know, writing down your memories and writing down what would eventually become Girls in the Hood, did you have any memories that you eventually included in the memoir, but that you felt really challenged to write or maybe even a little uncomfortable to write? And if that's the case, how did you push through that?
I had a good first draft editor who helped me push through some things that I originally included. And then I took them out because, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier about to this day, I don't understand some motivations of things that were happening. My mother at one point was trying to get a restraining order against my brother, my older brother, who was going through some mental illness challenges, shall we say. And she'd written this letter to the social workers, to the police, to whomever were listen, you know, to the senators. And I included that letter originally. And my editor said, you know, she sounds demented in this letter. I said, yeah, she does sound a little demented in the letter. You know, it was shrill. And, you know, she was, of course, afraid for her son. She was afraid for her family. She was afraid for herself. And he said, probably let's take it out because it can't be explained. It can't be explained. It is what it is. It was an actual letter, which I still have. And I said, I can't explain it. I can't get into her motivation. And so there are some things that I left out, and I left them out on purpose.
I mentioned this last week, but I'll say it again. I think memoirists are so brave to write about personal experiences, and you're writing about your immediate family. Did any of your immediate family have an opportunity? Have they read Girls in the Hood? And did you get any feedback?
I got some feedback from my good friends, but I didn't get feedback from my family because they're still involved in their stuff. And when I say their stuff, I mean, I have a sister who's a crack addict and involved in some crime. There's some involved in some crime, some things that they really shouldn't be involved in. And I didn't give the manuscript to them. They heard that I was writing it from family, friends kind of thing. And I was given emails that said, don't air the family's dirty laundry. They didn't say it wasn't true. They said, don't air the family's dirty laundry. What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Why are you trying to make us look bad? Which is not true at all. But in their state, they can't logically process why even I've written this memoir. So no, I didn't get their approval or disapproval, really, because they didn't read it. My friends read it. Some of my friends read it. My friends who grew up with me, actually, they grew up with me and they saw these things. They read it. They were astounded at the things that happened inside the house because they saw the things that happened outside the house. I never really had that problem that some memorists, I think, have about, I'm going to tell the family's dirty laundry. You know, I realize that it takes a certain amount of courage to tell the story as it happened. And when I used to read Maya Angelou in her early books, I read those in junior high school. And I said, wow, she's telling all this stuff about the things she did, and not all of it was great. But she's telling our story. So you got to push past the fear. If you want to tell our story, as Lorraine Hansberry said, tell our story, you know? And so, yeah, that's what I've done.
Yeah, I think that's great. And again, there is something about Girls in the Hood that feels very universal in some ways, even though it is about your family in particular. And so I think it is an important memoir for that reason. It's important for you, I'm sure, to get that on page and have your legacy there. But again, anyone actually could pick up Girls in the Hood and really understand what was happening in South Central during that time period. It feels like that to me. It offers a broad understanding in addition to drilling down to very, very personal particulars.
So I'm going to follow up on that, if I may. So Mary, who do you envision your audience is for this book, and what do you hope that they will take away from it?
I envision my audience as everybody. It's everybody's story. If you want to gain some insight into people and how people live and why they behave in the ways that they do behave, I think that you can get that from Girls in the Hood, from this memoir. And so I think that the audience, it's open to all audiences. I mean, in particular, I think African-American women and girls very rarely, if ever, see themselves on the page rendered so, this is just so raw, okay? And so I think those people in particular will understand it. But I think that it's a story for everybody. I was at a workshop and this woman wrote about being, she was the daughter of a resistance fighter in Norway, World War II. And she'd written this memoir. It was fabulous. She'd written this fabulous memoir and she'd workshopped some of it and I heard some of it. And afterward, I came up to her and I said, did we have the same mother? It's like, her mother was so like at the ready to fight for what was right. And it was a universal story. And she said, I don't think we had the same. I'm like, there's a lot of stuff in your mother in there. And so I think that it's a universal story and people can see how do people survive this place, these experiences, because it's also a survivor's story. I'm the survivor.
It is. It's very much a story of hope, too. I remember reading years ago, Jeanette Walls' The Glass Castle. It's a memoir of her growing up with her family, and her parents had some mental health issues and they lived in poverty. But ultimately, it was a memoir of hope. And I think that anyone who picks up Girls in the Hood, who might be just living through something very difficult at the moment, could read that book and see what you've accomplished as an adult and think, I can do that too. I can do that. I can survive this. So it's wonderful in that way.
Thank you. I also enjoyed The Glass Castle when I was looking for comps. And I'm going to have you guys explain comps in a second. And I was looking for comps, which was almost impossible to find because there's not a book really like mine. But when I was looking for comps, I was recommended, another writer recommended The Glass Castle, and I read it. I loved it so much. I cannot even begin to tell you. I loved it so much. And even though this is a white family, some of the experience was so familiar to me. As I read this book, I'm like, that happened. That happened too. Mm-hmm. And so, and I felt in a way that someone was telling some universal story of frankly, poverty. And how you can grow past the position the society puts you in. And so I agree, The Glass Castle, hands down, great memoir, great stuff. And I was going to ask you guys to explain the comps, which I had a term I had to learn.
Sure. Well, I suppose initially when you provide comps at the request of a publisher, we ask our authors for comps when we're first considering bringing them on board or offering them a contract, is essentially where they see their title as fitting in the marketplace, what kind of other published works they think are synergistic or reach a similar audience, and then perhaps the reasons why. And that can be useful when you're looking at ultimately selling a title and positioning it in terms of marketing and with the distribution metadata as to how best to situate a particular title. So it certainly makes a lot of sense from a publisher's perspective, but I can certainly see that it can be challenging for an author because ultimately everybody's book that they have written is quite unique.
I think it might be a little different, maybe a tiny bit easier for novelists because we are often, I consider myself a fiction writer and a hopeful novelist, but I think we are in some ways often not copying, every story is its own story, but we're copying in some ways books that we've loved. Whereas you've set out to write your own story. And as Janie said, your story is very unique. And as far as comps go, I think it's just booksellers need to know where to put that book on a shelf. And that's really what it boils down to. And where would it fit there? So, and thank you for asking that question, because I'm sure we have listeners out there who are also wondering about this business and what is this business with comparable titles. So that's a good one.
Mary, I want to ask you about the work of fiction that you're currently engaged upon. But before I do that, I would really love it if you would read an excerpt from Girls in the Hood. Do you think you might do that for us?
Sure. This is in a chapter 3, Sarah's Brood, where I talk about my brother Bobby, who at that time was about 15 years old. And I think I was about 8 or 9. And what happened is that he and one of his friends, Terry Thomas, was caught trying to throw an incendiary device off of a local church at about 2 a.m. in the morning. And they got caught. And I wanted to read this particular section because I think it speaks to our current moment. Like, people are saying, why are there protests in the street? Why are police being targeted, or a belief that police are being targeted? I think it speaks to our current moment in the sense of how is the what used to be called the inner city, South Los Angeles, Black communities, how are they policed? What happens when they police? I want you to think about, does the punishment fit the crime kinds of things? Because they were involved in a dangerous activity that they shouldn't have done. Also, our current time, you know, kids are setting off explosions and fireworks everywhere, and they're getting into trouble. Think about if it's your child, how would you want the police to handle that? So I'm going to read this little section of Girls in the Hood, Memoir of Mama in South Central Los Angeles. Bobby was brought out of a back room. My big brother looked smaller somehow. He was bent over and his eyes were bloodshot. He was cradling his right arm that was wrapped in a sling. It looked like he was rocking a baby. His white t-shirt was torn and his jeans were muddy. There were no laces in his sneakers. My mother went to Bobby and tilted his chin toward her. She moved his head gently from side to side, inspecting his face with the practiced eye of a mother who regularly bandaged skin knees and applied cool cloths to hot foreheads. When she was satisfied, she patted her son on the back and squeezed his good arm. Then she gave him that mama stare, which we all thought of her as her superpower. Look me in the eye, boy. Did you do what they say you did? Bobby nodded and cast his eyes down. He looked like he might cry. The detective walked over. He handed my mother a stack of papers and an ink pen. Just so you know, we won't be filing charges against Terry Thomas either. His grandmother already picked him up. My mother said nothing. She signed the papers and we exited. There was no conversation on the bus ride home. We sat on either side of my mother on the 3-person handicapped bench in the front. It was the same bus and the same driver for the return trip. The air was still too hot. When we got home, my mother took Bobby into her room and closed the door. I grabbed a glass and put it to my ear and tried to listen through the door. I couldn't hear a thing. Why did this always work in the movies? I almost dropped the glass when I saw the doorknob turn. I held it to my chest as I scrambled to the sofa. Bobby exited, and he was only wearing his underwear and that sling on his arm. He went into the boys' room and closed the door. Mother called me into her bedroom. I tried to get my lie straight about eavesdropping. This was switch-whooping territory, and I knew it. Look here, gal. You ain't got no cause to talk about this to no nosy neighbors, right? You didn't hear nothing worth repeating at that door, right? No, ma'am, I lied, and I was excused. I decided that it was best to go with the source. I went to the boys' room and gave Bobby the shave and a haircut knock. The two bits knock came back from the other side, and I knew I could enter. Bobby, who was always seemed to be bouncing off the walls with energy at all times, just looked sad and tired. Are you okay? I asked. Yeah, but Mama said not to gossip about it. He said, I'm tired. I just want to go to sleep. I felt bad for the guy. I didn't think he would get a whooping over it. My mother probably figured he had suffered enough. I figured the same. So I just left the room. It wasn't long before Terry was back at our house. I asked him what had happened the night that Bobby broke his arm. He told me, shoot, you should have seen them motherfucking pigs with their guns drawn on us like we was Dillinger or some shit, Terry said. I ran down the ladder in the back. They got me in the alley and brought me around the front. And I look up and Bobby was still up there looking into the police spotlight like there was pussy on the other end of it or something. And then the cop said to the loudspeaker, you can jump down or we can shoot you down. So this crazy ass nigga jumped onto the police car. He was screaming and rolling around like a dog hit by a truck. I could see they just wanted to shoot him, to shut him up. If I wasn't there as a witness, they probably would have shot him and planted a piece on him or something. I probably saved this crazy nigga's ass. Wow, I said, you could have been killed. Gonna take more than a couple of stupid cops to take me out, he said proudly, crossing his arms. Why was y'all trying to burn down a church? I said. We wasn't trying to burn down no church. That church is the tallest thing on the block. When you go up high, you can see more, Terry said. We was going to light them cocktails on fire and throw them down in the street and watch them explode, just like fireworks. Y'all could have been killed, I said, in my best mini mama voice. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, he said, and wasn't no cars and no people. Damn, people scared of everything nowadays.
That's great. I love that. When I read that, one thing that really struck me about Bobby, the scene where he comes out of Mama's bedroom and he's his arms in a sling and he's just wearing his underwear. And my overwhelming thought was, he's a kid. He's still a baby. You know, he's such a kid. That was a very powerful scene. And as you say, Mary, particularly with what is going on today, I think, does the punishment fit the crime? That is a question we likely don't ask often enough.
That was a beautiful reading, Mary. Absolutely beautiful. You're working on a work of fiction now, you said. What's it like transitioning mentally and literarily from a memoir to a work of fiction? My background is in archaeology, and I remember when I first started writing fiction, because, you know, as you mentioned before, in journalism, there's all sorts of standards to truth that necessarily need to be observed. And when I was writing papers for history or for archaeology, you know, everything had to be footnoted ad nauseum, and of course it had to be verified and vetted and all of that. So when I first started writing fiction, I felt quite naughty. I thought, my goodness, I'm actually making things up. This is marvelous. So I'd love to hear about your experience transitioning from memoir, where you're recreating that childhood environment, to now working with fictional characters.
Yeah, it does feel quite naughty. It's so freeing. I went to that same workshop last year and I started workshopping my latest book. It's called Grandma's Hand. And it's about these three grandmothers raising their grandchildren and in different situations. And they all come together. And it was so freeing. You know, it's like that time you come in the evening and you take off the bra, you know. So, oh, this is so good. But it's so freeing because, but I still have those things in my head. So I'm writing, you know, they're based on real women. So I'm writing and I still have this thing in my head. And I'm like, well, would she say this? She didn't say that. And I'm like, she could say that because I'm making it up, you know. So it's very freeing, and I'm having a really good time. I'm having such a good time writing this and workshopping this. And Marla Miller, who has a show called Hooking Readers, and she on Tuesdays and Thursdays she has a writing workshop that she's doing through Zoom, and I'm reading parts of it and I'm getting feedback from it, and I'm having such a good time. So it's really different. It's really different writing fiction. I had no idea how different it was going to be.
Well, I'd like to say thank you to Mary for being our guest on A Conspiracy of Lemurs this afternoon. It has been such a pleasure talking to you about Girls in the Hood, and I can't wait for it to come out into the world.
Thank you, Mary. It's been such a great conversation. I've enjoyed talking with you and listening to you read your own work, which was amazing. It's so much fun to hear you read. And thank you for your time. This was great.
And thank you, Janie. And thank you, Pam. It's just really terrific. And I had such a great time. We have to do this again sometime.
And for those listening in, Girls in the Hood will be coming out in the fall of 2021 and will be available for pre-order on our website early next year. The very best way to support an indie press is to buy books directly from their website, and we are very grateful for your support. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a review. We'd love to hear from you. We hope that you will join us for our next episode on A Conspiracy of Lemurs, the second in our historical fiction series, Historical Fiction or Historical Truth, with Karen Quivillon and Mitchell James Kaplan. From all of us at Regal, keep reading.